friends, as Kate mentioned, it's Friday with Jim. And interestingly enough, I'm your host, Jim. Jim Wilkins here. And Kate Brister is our engineer today. Thank you, Kate. The Friday show was conceived of and implemented by Lisa Smith, and who's, I think, in Abu Dhabi right now. But wherever you are, Lisa, hello. And happy to have with me as a guest this morning, Matt Winters, the editor, publisher, whatever, of the Chinook Observer. Matt, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
Matt has come up with an amazing ledger talking about some old-time salmon packing information. We'll be talking about that. But until we do, Matt, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, Jim, it's great being here this morning with you and Kate and here at KMUN. I'm a big fan of the station and have known you for so long, since arriving here 25 years ago to be editor of my beloved little paper across the river. I'm involved over on this side of the river too, both in terms of writing columns and editorials and doing a few other things with Daily Astorian, and also editing and publishing Coast River Business Journal. So, you know, I arrived here, I largely grew up in Wyoming, where my mother's family is from, but my dad was from Bellingham, and my grandfather was sawmill worker in Bellingham at about the time the ledger that we're going to talk about was being compiled. It was an interesting time in Washington State and Pacific Northwest history, with a lot of labor foment, and, you know, I guess there are always a lot of interesting news items going on in whatever era we live, but it was a particularly interesting time in America as a whole, with just so much immigration from so many places. America, as always, was a real magnet for other cultures. So I'm really fascinated by Pacific Northwest history. And as a consequence, a great many of my columns revolve around things like this ledger. I recently wrote one about a document I found from a Portland saloon that turned out to have been owned by a Civil War veteran, and that was a springboard for talking about the Washington Territorial Militia. And so all these sorts of documents, you know, many of them are dull through and through, but some of them are clues to a bygone age in our culture, when the things that we know and love were really getting some momentum. In some cases, things that we know and don't love were getting momentum too. But, you know, you can't understand the present without understanding the past. That's something all too few people really honor and incorporate into their lives. It gives you a lot better perspective for what's happening, and makes you appreciate that we have inside jobs today.
Yeah, especially with the kind of weather.
Yeah.
Well, you've brought in this really kind of massive ledger.
Right.
How did you come about getting that thing? It looks like it's mm-hmm. pretty old.
Yeah, it's a I've done a lot of work with salmon industry and cannery history over the years. I lived for a number of years in Altoona, which is a fishing village, or the remnants of one, on the Washington side of the estuary, and got involved in really being interested in at that point, the Altoona cannery was still standing. As so many, it fell into the river. The ones that didn't fall in have burned down for the most part. But out on that shoreline, there still exists one of the last historic canneries, the Pillar Rock Cannery, which it would be wonderful to find a way to save permanently as a wonderful tribute to that era. But so as a consequence of that interest, I've gotten involved with people like Irene Martin, with whom I did the history of the Columbia River Packers Association and Bumblebee Seafood several years ago. She and I are slowly working our way toward completion of another cannery book that will take a more cursory look at all of the canneries on the Columbia River from start to finish. So I'm very derelict in my duties in trying to get that wrapped up. Every one of these historical, local historical books, I love to do them, but they're a huge amount of work for the, there's never really any financial payoff for them, but it's, it's a great thing to do just to commemorate local history. So in any event, I'm known as someone with a great interest in that area. And so my friend John, who owns a wonderful little store in Long Beach called Hobo Junction, which is a lot of architectural salvage and, beach-combed materials, things like, Japanese oyster line buoys and things that have drifted across the ocean. He's just constantly on the search for things and picks up anything that he thinks might be interesting or valuable. And so this came into his and his late wife Maria's possession, I gather, a few years ago. Just had been thrown away, and he came across it. I don't think it was literally dumpster diving, but it was on its way to the landfill. And they recognized it as being at least a very interesting set of documents, and so they set it aside, and it's just been gathering dust since then. And my friend Brett Hopkins, who's one of our Washington fish and game officers, and John were talking, and Brett suggested that John bring it in to me, and I was instantly captivated by it and turned around within about a week and wrote the column that generated this conversation this morning. It's, it was common for all companies in that day to keep really detailed records, as it still is. This one is somewhat unusual, or it differs, I guess, from the CRPA records that I'm more familiar with, in that the McGowan and Sons Salmon Cannery, which is located, or was located, primarily where that beautiful little church is located just before the Chinook Tunnel, if you're ever heading across to the Long Beach Peninsula. That was the town site, and that was where the big cannery was. McGowan and Sons was one of the earliest canneries. And their bookkeeper, who may have been P.J. McGowan himself for all I know, glued individual bills and ledger sheets into this, huge old bound ledger, which I suppose is something like, 14 inches wide by maybe 22 inches, 24 inches tall.
It's definitely a big book, and we've got it sitting here in the studio between Matt and myself. It's an impressive document.
Yeah, it's old yellowed sheets, and it's got a musty smell to it, but it's it's just loaded with really, for a nerd of industrial history, it's just great stuff. It's basically any page has interest if you know what to look for. So, that's the sort of thing I went through. I could probably write an entirely additional column about all the things that I left out that I found interesting in it, but I won't impose that on my readers. But, there is just a lot of interesting stuff. The thing that I focused on in my column, and which I think really sparked an interest among many people in the community, was the fact that this ledger is, I think, somewhat unusual in that it actually documents by name and profession the work of what was once called the Oriental Crew. And, we sort of shy away from the word Oriental now as being kind of not exactly derogatory, but it just lumps a whole bunch of individual cultures into one big piece when they were very unique and interesting cultures in their own right. But we're talking about, in this era, Japanese and Chinese workers, subsequently Philippine workers were a big factor in at least the Astoria side of the salmon business. And, you know, these were the people that worked in the actual canneries as opposed to the fishermen. There were laws, I believe, in both states for much of the 19th and the early 20th century that barred non-whites from participating in the actual fishing business, which was, on the one hand, far and away the most lucrative aspect of it all, but one could also say probably the most dangerous, because there were a lot of lives lost in it and probably less risk associated with working in a cannery. But I guess in my mind, I have had the view that probably the Chinese and Japanese workers were second-class citizens and were paid accordingly. And I was interested from the basis of this ledger to find that actually they were pretty well paid by the standards of the time. Mm-hmm. This ledger just covers half a year. It's the second half of 1905. And so it doesn't cover the very lucrative spring salmon runs. But even for this second half of the year, a lot of the high-skilled Japanese worker, or not Japanese so much as Chinese workers, were making, in some cases, I would suspect something like $600 or $700 for the half year, and probably half again as much for the early months of the season. So conceivably, some of them made as much as, you know, verging on $1,000 in a year, which for 1905 was pretty good money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to correlate exactly how cash changes in value over the course of time. There are various formulas to do it with, and there are online programs where you can enter a number and it'll come up with an estimate based on inflation rates. I came up with, in one case, a payment for 1 month's of worth of salmon delivered to a cannery by a German-American as coming out to about $90,000 today. And that was just the month of August. And so for many of the individual fishermen, in that case, he was the operator of a salmon trap. I think for many people who have moved here in recent years, there's still some mystery attached to what some of the old pilings sticking out of the river are. And in at least some cases, there's still the surviving signs of salmon traps, which were sort of like fish corrals, which were pointed out toward the mouth of the river, and they were lined with tarred net, so the salmon couldn't see them as they moved upriver in the dark. Horrible environmental factor, obviously, and there are still signs of petroleum products along the shorelines in places like Chinook, where tar tanks were once located to coat those old nets with tar. And they were outlawed in, I believe, around about 1930 by statewide initiative in Washington, and might have been outlawed even sooner than that in Oregon. And but they were a very efficient way of catching a lot of salmon at one time. And that was the controversial aspect of it, of course. Even back a century ago, people were worried about run depletion. And so those methods that came to strike people as being unfair were slowly eliminated, with seining eventually being outlawed. And it eventually came down to being gill netting as the option of choice, because it allows so much differentiation between what you catch. It's a very customized way of harvest as opposed to what its opponents sometimes have alleged. So by varying net size and placement and all those things, you can decide what you want to catch. But fish traps were pretty indiscriminate in those days. They probably just hoovered up and harvested everything that swam into them. And so they made the participants a lot of money. That particular German-American, we actually covered in the course of doing our centennial project of the Chinook Observer back in the year 2000. He was a a guy named Louis Hoff, and he was an interesting character. He made all this money. He was made a fortune by the standards of the time, probably translated into today's money, several million dollars at least in terms of liquid wealth, and decided that he'd move back to the home country in around about 1905 to 1910. And of course, we know what happened to Germany soon thereafter, and he lost everything in the course of the war and was thrown on the charity of old acquaintances here at the mouth of the Columbia for the just to stay alive in the shattered remains of Germany after the First World War.
Well, Matt, I'd like to remind our listeners that we're Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with Matt Winters, the editor of the Chinook Observer, and also the recipient of this amazing ledger describing some of the transactions that occurred during the early days of salmon fishing here on the Columbia, and particularly with immigrant labor, specifically Chinese. I wonder if you could, Matt, talk a little bit about that, the Chinese.
Yeah, the Chinese were just a huge part of our economic success on the West Coast. They probably, for industry of a century ago, filled, in some cases, a similar role to Hispanic immigrants today, in that they were willing to do jobs that others sometimes found just too dang hard or distasteful. Yeah. One of the professions listed for the Chinese crew in this McGowan ledger is a slimer, which salmon generate some slime, and it was his job to de-slime the salmon in the canning process. But it's probably not the sort of thing that your typical worker was just clamoring to do. But he made decent money for doing it. I think he was paid something like $125 a month or thereabouts, $130, $150. They were all paid sort of in that range, except for sort of top butchers and can fillers. I found an example of a member of the Lum family. I doubt it's any connection to our current Lums in Astoria, but he filled more than 90,000 one-pound cans in 1 month in 1905.
Whoa.
He was the star can filler far and away. And I think he made $175 for it, which, I imagine he had awful aching fingers. So throughout this era, it was the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act. Many Chinese arrived in this country during the course, particularly of the gold rush. They, like people from around the world, were attracted to the West Coast with the temptation of supposedly easy wealth in the gold fields. And so they came over, thousands and thousands of them, in the 1840s, 1850s. Their role is, I suppose they originally hoped to be miners like everyone else, but in many cases they quickly cottoned onto the fact that the real money was in support, as was true of many in the gold rush. Very few actually struck it rich digging for gold, but quite a few made a lot of money providing things like fried oysters and clean sheets for miners. So they came, many of them, or a vast majority of them, I suppose, were men, and they came and encountered a lot of racial prejudice. There was, as was the case, I'm sure, even for my own family in Washington Territory, a feeling that they were willing to work and do jobs for somewhat less than European Americans were. And so there was a lot of animosity toward them. And so the Exclusion Act was a federal legislation which was mirrored in state laws and policies, things like the rule I mentioned that excluded them from being fishermen, that made it sort of marginalized them as citizens in some cases. And so that led to things like the very robust chapter of the Ku Klux Klan here in Astoria and in my family's hometown of Bellingham, where sometimes hundreds and thousands of hundreds or thousands, not hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, largely laboring class people, would march through the streets with hoods as members of the KKK. Some of it was directed, as it is now, at African Americans, but African Americans were not in much evidence in pioneer times in either Oregon or Washington. In Oregon, they were systematically excluded from settlement here for decades. So a lot of that KKK activity was really directed more at Chinese and, to a lesser extent, Japanese than it was anybody else. And so you had this group of men here from China, most of whom ended up staying and becoming great citizens, and their families still live on the West Coast today. For the most part, here along the Columbia River and in subsidiary places like Willapa Bay, they would come up for just the canning season and then go back home, oftentimes to the Bay Area in California the off season, which was also true in many cases of the actual cannery opener, cannery owners themselves, who were seasonal residents here and oftentimes had great fancy houses, but had even greater fancier houses in places like Oakland and San Francisco. So it was this seasonal tide of both capital and labor up here to make money out of fish. It was, as was true of forestry in those times, there was this enormous resource which was essentially free, or treated as being free, and which was converted into money. And, you know, in the case of my grandpa, it was trees, and I'm here thanks to that heavy exploitation of our natural resources, but we can still in some cases regret that it was as robust as it was in some instances. So the Chinese came, they mostly left again. Some of that was, there were anti-Chinese riots, particularly in Washington state, I believe probably to a lesser extent here in Oregon, that they still came and had to make a living, but they didn't.
Were the Chinese able to vote?
No. Yeah, I forget what the date was when they finally were really conferred true citizenship, but it was quite a while. They weren't really oftentimes considered citizens when they came over, and you know, I'm sure there were exceptions, but I think for the most part they didn't. So you had the Chinese, which were a really robust force, and then the Japanese were a somewhat less of a factor in the salmon industry. They were extremely important in the Willapa Bay oyster industry, and continue to be to some extent even today. But they were forced into internment camps at World War II, and so much of the Japanese influence in the oyster industry also withered away in that era.
What am I hearing, Kate?
You're hearing that this is a live broadcast, yeah, and people are standing too close to the door. Oh. We've got just a few minutes left.
Yeah.
I did want to ask Matt a question of my own. Was there a portion of the ledger that particularly struck out to you? What was the inspirational point that said, oh my goodness, I've got to read this whole thing, I've got to do something with it? Was there any particular moment that you just went, oh, this is gold?
Well, there's a lot of it that, you know, I can sort of sympathize a little bit with whoever threw it away, in the sense that it's kind of ugly, and it's not immediately obvious why someone would be interested in it unless you're a fan of local history. So there were a great many things about it that reached out and grabbed me. There were things, for example, like the fact that the phone bills at that period. It was, you know, very early in the phone industry, 1905. It was really still a pretty new technology, at least out on this coast. And so you come to the bills and all the calls are actually handwritten out. They would just keep a tally of the calls coming from any particular phone and who placed the call and who received it. And so coming from the McGowan Cannery, this was their branch actually in Iwako, they would get a long distance charge calling that, I would guess probably, I don't know, something on the order of 10 or 12 miles from McGowan to Iwako was 25 cents to place a call. And in some cases, most of the calls were made by owners and white European-American workers. But in some cases, you'll come across an entry that just says Chinaman under either the caller or the recipient of the call. I was struck by some of the amounts of money, as I said, that were made by fishermen. I was pointing out to Jim as we were coming in to get ready to discuss this that there are a lot of individual bills from fishermen here. Basically, they were paid oftentimes by either the month or by the week, depending upon how active the season was. And so I have, for example, here a bill for, let's see, I think the first name is Walgram or Nels Graham. Graham is a well-known fishing family in Iwako in any event. So on the 29th of August, 1905, he brought in and was paid for a little over 13,000 pounds of big Chinook salmon at 6 cents a pound. They had a separate payment for small Chinook salmon. Again, I'm gathering. In my column, I said I thought it might be silvers, but there's actually a separate entry for silvers. So I think we're talking about just probably 6 cents a pound for the big old June hogs that people like Hobe Kider on this side of the river speak about so warmly, the hogs that could top 90 pounds in some cases. They actually, I think in some cases, had to, you know, let them rot a little bit and pound them into the can because the flesh was just so firm that, you know, it wasn't willing to be manipulated by us. So, you know, he made $800 for big salmon, about another 100 for small Chinook salmon. Then they were paid a fairly good 5 cents a pound for steelheads. And then bluebacks and silvers were grouped together, in his case, a little over 1,000 pounds on this particular payment, for which they got 3 cents a pound. And then tule, which are immature Chinook salmon, were paid just a flat dime apiece, irrespective of weight. So on this particular delivery, he had one tule salmon for which he was paid a dime. So his total payment for that one delivery was $950. And so when you think about that, that's probably, I would say, inflation adjusted, just off the top of my head, I imagine that's around 25 grand today for that one delivery. So it's no wonder that places like Chinook, Washington, and Iwako, and Astoria, and Warrenton were thought of as being some of the wealthiest communities in America in that era. It was just an amazing amount of money that they were able to just create by scooping fish out of the river and, you know, packing it in a can and cooking it up and slapping a label on it. I figured out that basically the profit margin in some cases, you know, the inputs in terms of cans and things are a little hard to figure, but they were probably making, in some cases, they were paying 6 cents a pound for great salmon and turning around and selling it wholesale for maybe 19 cents a can. So, even with inputs, they were probably doubling their money on every pound of salmon they sold there for a number of years. Salmon canning, I should say, okay, I guess we're wrapping it up. I could go on and on, obviously, but thanks so much to you both for having me today. I really have enjoyed being here.
Yeah, Matt Winters, publisher, editor of the Chinook Observer. I appreciate you being with us. An interesting conversation. And this ledger that you found is an amazing document. And Matt right now is keeping it in his basement.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that eventually he wants to put it in a place where people can go see it, for example, perhaps the Maritime Museum.
Well, I hope that John from Hobo Junction and I can cooperate and get it someplace where it'll be saved forever.